Is Brett here?
No, he's supposed to be.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. It is April 3rd, Wednesday. We have a couple of announcements. One is under work sessions, Senate Bill 117, and Senate Bill 692, the amendment paperwork is not ready, so we're going to carry those over. Senate Bill 112 is ready, and so we're going to start with opening up a work session on Senate Bill 112. And Beth, if you can remind us what that bill does, and then I think we will ask the OLCC to come up and talk about the amendment.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 112, there's a dash 5 amendment on OLIS in your packet and in the back of the room. There's a minimal revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on the dash 5 amendment. The amendment in front of you establishes that the maximum daily fine is $500. That clarifies the Act's authority to impose civil penalties is in addition to and not in lieu of revocation, suspension, or criminal penalty authority. It authorizes the Commission to audit the distributor, the cooperative distributor or importer, if in the course of their review the Commission determines it is necessary, and establishes the process for that audit.
Okay, thank you. So I'll have Tom from the OLCC come up. And committee members, if you remember, we heard this early on, and this was a follow-up to the bottle bill about how we can make sure that when the distributors provide information to OLCC, that there is an opportunity to review that information. I want to thank my vice chair, who worked with the different parties to come up with, I believe, some consensus language. And so, Tom, if you can walk us through the amendment, appreciate it.
Chair Dienfelder and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Irwin. I'm the Government Affairs and Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm not sure I can add a whole lot more that the committee administrator has already given you. First of all, I need to get the right bill in front of me. I have Senate Bill 117.
Fives. That's the dash fives.
The dash fives of 112. Yes, we were concerned, of course, about the ability to verify information and ask for some additional information that gives us the ability to request an audit. And the language in here does that. We're satisfied with it. We think this is going to get us there. Worked with OBRC and the other members and DEQ. All the players were at the table when we walked through this, and we've shared all this information with all of those folks as well. And OLCC is satisfied with the amendments regarding the audit language. And additionally, I think there was some request to reduce the amount of the civil penalty from $5,000 to $500. And again, we're satisfied with that as well. I'm not sure there's a whole lot more here other than, as I scramble through it quickly, I apologize.
That's
Chair.
Okay.
I didn't tell her I didn't know it was going to be coming
you
up.
We will be implementing this, so you're going to make sure that
all of our folks have analyzed this, and, okay, and we're satisfied and comfortable with the language.
Okay, great.
The amendment.
I'll see if there's any questions for the OLCC. Senator Olson.
Sir, I just want to make sure that we've got the right game here now. And remember, one of our discussions was audit or review. You're comfortable with the verbiage as it is.
Chair Dienfelder, Senator Olson, yes, we are. Our chief financial officer reviewed each of the proposed language changes as we walked through it and changed various things. So we are comfortable that we will get there with this particular language.
Thank
where
you.
We need to be.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator? Nope.
Nope.
Okay, great. Thank you. So with that, I will take a motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendments dated 3/29/2013.
Okay, Senator Olson moves to adopt the Dash 5 amendments dated 3/29/2013. Is there any discussion? I just want to thank my vice chair for working on this. I know it looks like not a very large amendment, but it did take us a while to get there, and also for my staff and all the different parties that worked on this
staff
language.
Thank
yes.
You.
Thank you. Okay. Any objections to adoption of the Dash 5s? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Take another motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move Senate Bill 112 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 112 as amended with the dash fives to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Hanson?
Aye.
Senator Haas?
Excused.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Dinkelder?
Aye. With that, the motion carries. And Senator Olson, would you be so kind to carry the bill to the floor?
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
So please note that Senator Olson's going to carry the bill. Oh, and here comes Senator Haas. Before I drop the gavel, Senator Haas, you were excused on Senate Bill 112, the dash fives. Would you like to vote on these?
Yes, I would.
And how would you like to vote?
I would like to vote yes.
Okay. That was serendipitous. So please note for the record that Senator Haas voted yes, so it's a 5-0 vote. Senator Olson's carrying this to the floor. That will close the work session. And, okay. And we will then open up the public hearing on House Bill 2396A, because I do see we have the good representative here who's going to talk about this bill and tell us why it's needed. This is our first House bill that we're hearing. No, second one. And we've already sent off our first House bill. So thank you for being here. And please tell us what this bill does and why the Senate needs to hear this bill, Representative.
Well thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Brad Witt from Oregon's House District 31. And here on behalf of House Bill 2396A, this bill provides statewide protections for large woody debris. And very succinctly, large woody debris is fundamental to salmonid habitat. It is critical habitat. And this bill will provide statewide protections for it. Unfortunately, folks oftentimes find large woody debris in our riparian zones and cut it up for firewood. And it has a much higher value as salmonid habitat and opens opportunities for us to continue economic activities. Social activities that might otherwise be precluded should any of the salmonids incur an outside recovery program. The bill provides for very important exemptions for livestock, life, property, or transportation. In those instances, if it were to pose problems in any one of those arenas, folks would be able to move the large woody debris to avoid those kinds of problems. And with that, I would urge your favorable action on the bill and open myself to questions if there are any.
Thank you, Representative. Can you, for my committee members, make sure that they understand what riparian areas are and why woody debris would be located in them?
Okay. Riparian zones are actually those zones that are either water or close to the water. So stream banks, those sorts of things, and then perhaps upland to the furthest reaches of the water line. And this large woody debris does a number of items. It provides, in many instances, stream bank stability. In other instances, it provides cover. It provides shade. And actually, one of the most important functions is the recruitment of gravel, which is fundamental to many salmonids. Sometimes used in the digestion of food, and always used when the fish lay their eggs. So, absolutely a critical habitat recruitment.
And question: why would somebody remove a piece of wood especially that's either been put there through a flood or because of a habitat restoration project?
A plethora, really, of human activity, not the least of which, just pure and simple, cutting it up for firewood.
And my last question, and I'm sure there'll be some other questions, is under Section 5, where it talks about the provisions of ORS 196-600 to 196-905 do not affect the removal of large woody debris if the large woody debris under one, I'll ask you about the first two, and then we'll ask Department of State Lands about the third. So can you give us examples of when they would pose a direct and demonstrable danger to livestock, human life, or real property, or prevents the passage of a person, transportation, the beds, banks of the state? So on page 5.
An example of livestock, we would have large woody debris. There could be a spring freshet, and it dams a river close to cattle grazing area, and the cattle are unable to leave the area, much like, I guess, Tillamook is a prime example, and floods and could literally drown the livestock, and that woody debris could be moved to prevent that threat to the livestock. Human life, probably similar circumstances. Property, any kind of flooding that might be caused by woody debris certainly could be removed. It could be the deposition of the woody debris itself might be a problem. A spring freshet, and you know, you get a great big huge stump that's parked on your front porch, you could move it. Those sorts of things. Transportation, again, floods deliver a large volume of wood. It's backed up against a bridge. I witnessed that here in Salem in two flood events, and it actually was flooding part of the city and the streets, and that wood could be moved as a result.
All right, thank you. Let's see if there's any other questions. Senator Hansel?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Witt. I was just going to say that as former county commissioner on high water marks, a lot of our bridges become collection points for woody debris, and if we don't remove them, we'll lose the bridge, we'll lose the whole thing. So I want to make sure that, you know, and we got to move it fairly quickly sometimes. The road department, for example, could just go out and move it, wouldn't have to get permits or go through a process as well.
Madam Chair, Senator Hansel, absolutely. That's precisely why it was drafted as such.
The follow-up, and to your point on personal and real property, one of the primary ways, in my experience, that river streams change course, significant course, is, again, a large woody debris log, tree falls, and it redirects the whole course of the river to the point that it starts taking out pastures, buildings, roads, you know, that otherwise would have been fine, railroad trestles and or tracks. So again, if that is a threat, it can be removed.
Absolutely. And the notion was that we provide wide latitude to make that possible, to do that without a formal permitting process, to get that done quickly, to avoid the danger, and to be able to move that wood. The interest is in wood recruitment to the extent possible for additional salmonid habitat without imposing any kind of undue burden that any of us would not like to see happening to our property or livestock.
Thank you.
Senator Olson?
Yes, thank you, Representative. Question, who is the arbiter of your large woody debris? It's downed wood that captures gravel, provides stream stability, or provides fish habitat. Who would be the arbiter of whether that, in fact, is a definition, not the definition, but if a tree is in a stream, that it is actually doing these things? I'm only trying to clarify this. If a tree is down and somebody sees it, they could refer back to your section and say, well, it's going to inhibit transportation. But in fact, you know, is how do you determine that this tree that's in the water is actually capturing gravel, providing stream stability, or providing fish habitat?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think by the assumption is that a tree would, in fact, be large woody debris. I mean, that's that would be natural recruitment of wood into the riparian zone. That certainly would qualify. And under worst case scenario, nothing would change. I mean, you would have to the status quo, current regs would cover the situation. And frankly, to the extent that it is large wood, this is probably an easier route. And frankly, it's something that your question is something that I hadn't actually entertained up to this point, but I think provides an easier route in that instance. So.
Well, the reason I asked the question is, say for example, there's a guy canoeing down, and you know he sees the campsite, and there's some wood out there. If he were to cut this up, who would be the enforcer of it? Because this is going to be a difficult one to enforce. I understand where you're going with this. It's going to be difficult to enforce, and that's why I wanted to clarify what's large woody debris, because if it's on a stream near my house and I go and look at it, who do I call and say, come out and say, I need to get rid of this tree? So who would be the one I would be the arbiter that's saying, oh, it is large woody debris, or no, you don't need a permit because I don't think it's doing what this says?
Yes, it's Madam Chair, Senator Olson, it's typically the Department of State Lands that you would be applying for a fill and removal permit if it's over the aggregate. I think it's
5
cubic
yards
as I recall.
The tree has to be 5 cubic yards?
Well, I mean, that's the typical definition as it currently exists. So that changes nothing in state statute.
We have the department here, too. We can call
good.
Them
out. Okay. I'm not trying to give you a hard time on this, honest Scott.
Sure.
Because I think this is good. And the other question I would have is, in my particular instance, I have the Pudding River comes in and dumps into the Molalla River. And if a tree hangs up right there and it actually starts eroding a section of land, would that be exempt with the real property damage that someone could go, and it wouldn't be my land, but someone could go in and remove this tree because it's now changing the course of the river, or is that okay?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, quickly back to your earlier question.
Okay.
The number is 50 cubic yards.
That would be a big tree. Big tree.
Well, and what that does is that's the break point for requiring the permit.
Right.
So, you know, large volumes, you have to get the permit through DSL. Smaller permit, I mean, smaller volumes, you don't under this bill. If it's considered large woody debris, you can move it if it impedes any of the exemptions that we've already discussed.
But if it follow up, please. If it changes the course of the stream, is that fall under your exemption of real property, where it actually would divert the water into your land and start chewing up your land and changing the course of the river? Would you be allowed to remove that, or would you need to go to DSL and ask for permission?
If it threatens your property, and that that water course, that the current of that water course threatens your property. Maybe it's undercutting a bank and your barn is going to fall in the creek as a result. Yes, you could move that wood.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Right. You bet.
Senator Bates.
Thank you. I'm in kind of a funny position of both being in the past a homeowner with a creek that washed out my road a couple of times because debris gets in there at 3 o'clock in the morning, and a fly fisherman who understands what you're talking about. As I look through the bill, and this is my first look at it, so I want just a little bit more information. This is really eliminate a lot of, there's so many exemptions in this bill that what's left that you're trying to get to here? I mean, you know, I can almost think of anything I've seen in the stream where I thought, nice, you know, are we actually sometimes with Trout Unlimited, we put things in stream to improve habitat and to keep bait fishermen out. That's what we do.
Separate these two right here.
But well, seriously, what are you trying to accomplish with those? We have so many exemptions now. What are you really looking at here? Can you just give me a common sense look at this?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, there are some exceedingly large exemptions here. There's no question about it. And I think in order to be able to diminish to the greatest extent possible concerns that unintended consequences, unforeseen future events would in fact adversely impact somebody's property or their lives or their livestock. As a result of those concerns, you see the exemptions that are here. By and large, the vast array of large wood that's recruited to the riparian zone would still be protected under this bill. And so those of us who cut firewood, we wouldn't be able to go out and cut that up as firewood. It needs to stay there for is natural habitat.
Okay. So it's a tree that's washed out in the winter, drops in the stream, but it's not doing anybody any harm, stays there, nobody can pull it out, cut it up for firewood. That's a group trying to get through, really.
That's correct, or for any other purpose.
I understand, yeah.
Okay. Good questions. We appreciate you letting us pepper you with this line of questioning, but certainly trying to make sure we understand the bill.
Absolutely, yeah. And Madam Chair, I understand that that all of the questions are intended to allay the various concerns. I understand that people are rightfully concerned about wood that can back up and create flooding, and I would only say that as the representative of Vernonia and the two huge floods that have occurred in a decade's period of time in that community, I understand, and I understand very well, people's concerns about floods and what floods can do to their property, to their livestock, to the community, to the future viability of a community. I understand all of this, and I'm only too happy to try and in any way I might be able to give people the assurance that they need to be able to pass this bill and feel comfortable with it.
Great. Madam Chair.
Yeah.
I just saw something else. You mentioned Vernonia. I was up there in that flood area. If trees fall down and it looks like they could possibly pose a restriction and if we were to have a freshet or a large rainfall, would you call DSL or would the city call DSL and say, hey, these trees are going to be a problem to us, or could they just arbitrarily remove them under this bill?
Yeah, I believe that this bill allows that removal. Simply because of the allowance that is posing that threat, that you would be able to move forward and remove that that large wood, and that's why, as I said with your earlier question, I hadn't really given that consideration until you had asked the question. But I guess in some instances, it actually the bill makes it easier when it poses those threats to remove it. So.
Thank you. I thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Representative. I think what I'll do is I'll call up Department of State Lands and see if just make sure that they clarify some of these questions. If you want to stick around, you're certainly welcome to. We have about four people signed up to testify
Great.
On it.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Makes for very good
Thanks for bringing this forward, and we'll just so you know, we don't have work. We probably will not schedule a work session until after the Senate bills.
All right.
Thank are done you, because we have a lot of bills backed up. So if the Department of State Land wants to come up, I don't know if ODF&W wants to come up at the same time, and then we will call up the rest of the folks who wanted to testify. Might as well have both agencies here. Thank you. So do you want to maybe address some of the concerns that have been raised? And I don't know if you have specific testimony.
Madam Chair, Dean Felder, and members of the committee. I'm Bill Ryan from the Department of State Lands. I'm the Assistant Director of the Wetlands and Waterways Conservation Division. And we don't have prepared testimony. This bill, I think Representative Witt did a good job of explaining how the bill would operate. The intent is that there would not be a regulatory bottleneck for the removal of large woody debris that was presenting a risk to navigation or to property. And so I think it's pretty clear with the language there that would be the case. Enforcement would be a challenge if wood had been removed and basically figure out who removed the wood and whether it was providing being a risk or not. So enforcement would be challenging. So I don't anticipate a lot of enforcement happening with this, and I don't anticipate a lot of permits coming in requesting to remove the material either. So.
Okay. I do have a question for you, but maybe we should have Bruce go first.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce McIntosh, Acting Fish Division Administrator at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm not going to go through the detail that's in our written testimony, which details in great clarity what the role of wood is in stream and aquatic ecosystems. I can tell you that outside of water, I know of no more critical element to the protection and creation of fish habitat in the forested landscapes of the Pacific Northwest. In fact, 30-some years ago, Oregon State did the pioneering research on just what the role of wood was in these systems, and it since has been applied across really the globe. I think in addition, we have to remember that the region and the state for the last 20 years has invested millions of dollars putting wood back into streams. And I think when you look at what this legislation proposes, it gives the state the authority to make sure that we try to keep wood in streams, particularly with the exemptions associated with, health and damage and stuff. So from the department's perspective and from the fish perspective, this is a good piece of legislation.
Okay, I'm going to see if there's any questions.
I have one, of course.
Senator Olson, and then I have some questions.
And the reason that it just popped up, I was reading your testimony, and it slapped me in the head, this 1996 flood. Mallala River, I had eventually had waterfront property, which was kind of cool. But the question I want to ask is, upstream along 99E, there's a gravel pit, and in that gravel pit they had probably 500 to 600 cedar logs. And as the river rose, it went into this pit and drew those cedar logs out, and they ran downstream. And they were all over the place, and they actually came in that same year and helicopter logged them back out again. Would they need to leave those logs or come to you to require a permit to recapture their own logs?
Sounds like that one's yours, Bill.
It would be.
I know these are strange things, but these things happen, so it would be a question I would ask.
Sure, Madam Chair, Senator Olson. If the purpose of removing the logs was to recover them, technically I think they would be considered large woody debris, and you would need an authorization to do that if they were causing a threat to navigation or to livestock or real property or human life. Then they would need to be, then you could remove them without any kind of approval.
Follow up. So then my next question would be, in line, if they needed a permit to remove their own logs that had gotten away from them, what would it cost? What would the permit cost? Because you're talking a lot of wood. I mean, it was enormous where they hauled out truckload and truckload and truckload of this stuff. So I wondered what the permit fee would be.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the base fee for removal of material is $277, and then there's a higher fee for larger volumes. So the next volume up would be 500 cubic yards, which would be a lot of wood, and that would bring you up to the next next fee level. And I'm sorry, I don't have that on the top of my head, but it's somewhere around $400, something like that. And then the next gradation up is, I believe, 1,000 yards. So you're talking a lot of wood if you're talking 1,000 cubic yards of material. So it would be in the order of a few hundred dollars.
Follow up. Would you evaluate the wood on the cubic footage of the wood or the linear board feet of the wood, or how, because you're talking cubic yards, and that's typically not how wood is measured. So how would you do the analysis there or the analytical study to determine how much wood is being removed?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we would basically have to do a calculation based upon the number of logs and the approximate dimensions of the logs, and we would just go with the volume using a volume calculation. You know, using the radius of the logs and the length of the logs, you can determine the volume of the log. And that's what
right.
we'd end up doing.
Right.
And I'm going to ask a follow-up to his question, and then I'll take Senator Bates' question. So just to be clear, under 50 cubic yards exempt, like any other exemption, but the question is essential salmonid habitat?
Yes, so, Madam Chair, in essential salmonid habitat, that 50 cubic yard exemption does not apply, so any amount of material would be subject to requiring authorization from the department, provided it didn't meet those exemptions that are in the statute.
Okay. Senator Bates?
I just had a question about, it seems to be that in this particular episode you're talking about, they were trying to recover their personal property. They own these logs, and through a flood, they lost control of them. And I'm trying to get back to the original bill here. All I've got is the review of it here. It says a large woody debris is defined as any downed wood that captures gravel, blah, blah, blah. But it's downed wood, which strikes me as something that's fallen into the stream, not private property that's washed into the stream. Would that not maybe be something that under these conditions they'd say, we're just recovering our personal property. This isn't really downed wood. I'm not sure what the legal definition of downed wood is.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I'm not sure either. We don't have a legal definition of that. I think the intent is not to regulate people's recovery of property that's lost. I think we're talking about natural recruitment, and so that's the kind of circumstance that we could address through rulemaking to make it clear that you know, defining downed wood through rulemaking or defining the circumstances under which we would not regulate the removal of that material.
My follow-up to that would be, this is not as unusual an occurrence as you might think. We have lumber yards and mills close to streams for very good reasons. And in times of flood, you can get 2x4s, 2x6s, logs washed into those streams, and they try to recover that because it's economic damage to them if you don't. I would guess that is not covered by this. I would think they'd be exempt from this.
Madam Chair.
Center.
Could we have the representative come back up and see if there could be a possibility for just a clarification? Oh, we got the answer coming.
We've got his attorney advising him, it sounds like.
Uh-oh.
He is signed up to testify, by the way. Yes. The attorney. Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Witt again. First of all, I think we have to sort out the fact that this wood could be recruited into the riparian zone regardless of the existence of this bill or not. It then becomes an issue of have we endangered a property? Probably difficult to argue that that those logs that have been recruited, that there's a danger to those logs. So I don't think you get to remove them under that circumstance. But I think the issue is one of natural recruitment or not, and that may be something that folks who have a better legal grasp on this than I do might be able to better address.
Okay.
Well, Representative Witt, I apologize for causing these problems, but as I read the 96 and thought about the flood, it just
sure.
struck me that all these trees were in the water, and now are they covered or not? And I'm just trying to clarify that.
Well,
and if it can be clarified in rule, that would be perfect.
Well, through the chair again. There may be folks that are better positioned than I to describe. I think one could argue that there is a threat to that property, that property could be permanently lost absent that removal. But I have to admit to you very candidly, Senator, I'm challenged to make that argument. I'm just I'm not an attorney, and I would prefer that someone else answer that question for you. But I think there are grounds to make that argument.
Representative, you'll find that I think sometimes way outside the box.
All right, any other questions for any of these gentlemen?
Thank you, gentlemen.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We have somebody waving their hand, dying to testify in the back here, so we'll call up Rick Angstrom. And actually, I'm going to call Jim Myron up as well so we can start going through this. So Rich is an attorney, and we'll attempt to answer it. We'll see if we like his answer or not.
Half of you will, and half of you won't.
Is that what they taught you in law school?
That's exactly what they taught me in law school. Rich Angstrom, the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. This is a long bill that's been battled for about 10 years.
I was going to say 12. It was one of the first bills I heard when I was in judiciary 12 years ago.
It actually, when we were, Madam Chair, when we were on the Healthy Stream Partnership together, yeah. It was first surfaced. And the landowning community has kind of stayed away from this concept because it was one more permit that we had to get with the myriad of permits that we had to get from multiple agencies. But this time around, we worked during the interim, and then and I kind of got on point on this and helped move all the sides together on it. You won't see Ag or OFIC involved, but I've had conversations with them, and they're satisfied. At least they're not going to weigh in on it. And then worked with Representative Witt on what he needed to accomplish on this bill. The history is important because the landowner community has gone from a pretty strong opposition to either neutral or, in OCAPA's case, supportive. And there's a lot of things that brought us to that particular position. But one of them that I think is real important is there's no question that large woody debris in the river system can have a substantial benefit, and it can have a substantial, it can create a substantial problem depending on how it's managed. And what we try to do in this is find a balance between the two, and the exceptions actually allowed that to break loose as far as moving sides to more of a, at least OCAPA's case, a more supportive position. So we did, we've done, there's a bunch of things in here that are important. First off, what large woody debris does is it creates erosion. And when it's anchored in, it's going to push the water around and cause the stream to braid, which is really good for fish, right? I think if you just summarize basically ODF&W's paper, it would just come down to that. But erosion from a landowner's perspective may not be so good. In the case of the farmers, it's eroding into their banks and reducing the acres that they can farm and having an impact there. For us, on the coast at least, is we get these large woody debris root balls and logs that actually land right on one of our gravel bars that we're harvesting, and you end up with a scouring effect around that piece of wood, and we end up with smolts from our endangered fish that get captured in those depressions. And so then we have problems with NOAA fisheries and ODF&W about getting the smolts out and back into the river. And the process was we would take the large woody debris out. For us, what moved us on this bill was DSL saying that they would include in the permits that we already get conditions that allowed us to do that, and the bill allows for that. So we don't have to any longer get additional permits. It'll all be included in the permit that we get. So that was one thing. The other thing I wanted to point out was a couple of the questions. And let's start with the question from Senator Olson on the cedar logs. I think the word downed actually means something. And if the agency was really going to think about what that meant and get an interpretation of it, downed means something fell. And I would imagine it doesn't mean it washed out of an old gravel pit or a log storage yard. I would think that downed means something fell naturally, and it fell into the river, and it was having a natural impact on the river. Now, the hard part with that, I suppose, thinking it through, is we are placing wood and in the river system, and that's really not down. That's artificially placed. So I actually think the nuance is not so much on that in Senator Olson's example, but how we prevent folks from cutting up all of the, and this is part, big part of the problem, is we're putting all this money in, we've been on the rivers. We've seen them tied up with cables and anchored into the banks and big boulders put in to try to hold them in. And somebody comes up and cuts them up for firewood. And that's something we're going to have to think about. I know there'll be some amendments, so I'm going to have to noodle on that a little bit. So I actually think down means naturally, and it addresses that. The other thing I would like to point out is knowing that there are folks like Senator Olson out there that would create, that would think of some just really off-the-wall kinds of examples that might happen. There's a provision in there that allows the department to do a rulemaking if facts come up and they need to manage around it. And so that's what that provision is in there for. And I made it specific because I knew we couldn't think of every example of where large wood was either going to have a benefit or a problem, but I wanted to give the department a tool to be able to address it instead of having to run back here to deal with a new exception or a new interpretation or something of that nature. It just seemed to me to give the department discretion, allowed for this to end this debate, and you won't have to hopefully hear it for another few years. What's left, I think, was Senator Bates's question. The value of this is the fact that it will cause people to at least restrain their activity other than when it is one of these exceptions. So every time we do leave a piece of large woody debris in the river, and folks know we have to now, and it has that natural effect of pushing water around, causing erosion, scouring, doing all the good things that a large piece of wood does in the river for the salmon, everyone that we leave in there is a good thing. That's a benefit. And, of course, we had to balance that with real important needs from our side of it, which is protecting property interests. And the cattle example was specifically part of Farm Bureau's exemption for Tillamook County on that point. So I think that addresses the couple of points. We're supportive of this bill. It's been a 12-year battle, and hopefully we've got this pretty close to being able to button this issue up.
Any questions for Rich and Mr. Engstrom? Okay, I think we're going to hear point counterpoint here. Okay, Mr. Myron.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Jim Myron. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. And we've been part of this ongoing discussion for the last 10, 12 years, whatever it's been, or longer than that when you count in the Healthy Streams Partnership. But the intent of protecting wood in stream for fish habitat purposes is a very laudable goal and something that Native Fish Society has supported for a long, long time. We need to be doing that, and probably the best way to do that is to put wood in the fill and removal law so that you need a permit to take it out. That's, you know, voluntarily relying on people to leave wood in the stream rather than cutting it up as firewood doesn't seem to have worked so well. But unfortunately, we think that the exemptions in Section 5 are much, much too broad. I'm having a difficult time thinking about when wood could be protected if somebody wanted to remove it. You know, a direct and demonstrable danger, which is undefined, that leaves it up to the landowner to decide whether it does, you know, it does present that danger. And I'm probably going to start my chainsaw up and go cut the piece of wood. There's no requirement to notify anybody here. There's no, you know, under this provision, you can do it without a permit. And then the next one, the transportation exemption, is really odd because it allows any form of transportation in a stream bed or bank with no no stipulation as to what kind of transportation that pertains to. If they're trying to get at boat transportation, I can understand that because, you know, we need to keep the streams open for boat traffic, and sometimes you need to remove logs to do that. But you don't need to remove logs to allow somebody to drive their ATV down the stream bank. This, I think, would allow that to happen. So, there is another interesting piece in the existing law for emergency actions. On the same page of the bill, page 5, above the section 5 is a discussion of how to go about getting an emergency permit from the Department of State Lands to take out wood that is causing a problem or has a public health consideration. And all you need to do is pick up the phone and call them, and they can authorize that over the phone. It doesn't have to be a written permit. So why not use that section of the bill, that existing statute, rather than creating something new that's very undefined? So what we would like to do is work with the committee on some potential amendments to try and narrow this down and see if we can improve this bill before it goes to the floor of the Senate. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions for either of these gentlemen? Okay. All right. Thank you. Thanks for your comments, Mr. Myron. We have Tom Wolf, Jane Bacchieri, and Joe Rolater. Jane, do you want to go first?
Sure. Chair Dingfelder and Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee, my name is Jane Bacchieri, and I'm the Watershed Services Group Manager for the City of Portland's Bureau of Environmental Services. The Bureau of Environmental Services protects public health, water quality, and the environment for the City of Portland by providing sewage and stormwater collection and treatment, protecting surface and groundwater quality, and working for healthy watersheds. We support the intent of House Bill 2396 that moving or removing large woody debris in the waters of the state requires a permit. I'd also like to thank Representative Witt for his leadership on this bill. We respectfully suggest, however, that the bill be changed to protect newly placed or fallen woody debris that has not yet captured sediment and to place some reasonable limits on the exemptions in the bill. The Bureau of Environmental Services engages in watershed and stream restoration activities in order to improve water quality, restore watershed health, and address state and federal fish and wildlife regulations and policies. The Bureau places large woody debris in streams and waterways at a cost of approximately $800 to $1,000 per piece to restore stream channel morphology and enhance fish and wildlife habitat. For example, in the Lower Columbia Slough, the Bureau has a project to place over 640 pieces of wood to create large wood structures on city-owned property. And at Willamette Park, which is a highly developed and active city-owned park property, BES and Portland Parks and Recreation are developing a restoration project that would integrate up to 175 pieces of wood along over half a mile of riverfront in a manner that does not interfere with the boat launch, public access, or the use or enjoyment of the river. So both of these projects will benefit the 16 threatened salmon and steelhead populations that use the Willamette and Columbia Rivers in Portland. In addition, many private projects, such as bridge construction and port development projects, require large wood projects for environmental mitigation. We are concerned about the broad language being proposed in Section 5 of the bill. Section 5, Sub 1 and Sub 2 would create an entirely new way to undo habitat restoration investments and mitigation obligations under the lightest of tests. As written, anyone could easily claim that large woody debris is a hazard or impediment to passage or any form of transportation and have the ability to remove it without a permit. Such actions would compromise stream integrity and restoration efforts, which are essential to the recovery of a number of threatened and endangered species. We believe that the exemptions should be changed to preserve the ability to relocate genuine impediments to navigation while requiring the state's approval before carefully placed habitat enhancements and mitigation projects are compromised. Thank you very much for considering this testimony.
Thank you. Joe?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I'd forgotten about the Healthy Streams Partnership. I guess we all worked on this issue a long time ago. I'm a longtime board member of the ALC Watershed Council, and I'm here today to talk about some of the work that we've done. And our river was splash dam logged back in the 00s. And they built these little dams, and then when it got to be regular water coming down, they were all simultaneously broken, and it put the logs down into the bay where we could, my ancestors could log them. And as a result of that, all the wood was taken away. All the gravel was taken away. It's kind of a sterile environment. And so we've tried to put wood back in. And granted, in a natural system, wood moves through the system. Part of the reason that we have riparian protection areas is to generate large woody debris for future habitat. But we try to put the stuff in and keep it there. We used to try to cable it. That didn't work very well. Now, because we've got an agreement with the Forest Service, we use some pretty big logs, and we fly them in with a Chinook, and we, wherever possible, we try to put them in a pile, or if we have a road access, we shove them into the bank. And so basically, we're just trying to get the people to recognize that we spent a lot of money on this wood, and there's natural wood coming down at the same time, so that natural wood is worth a lot of money. It's worth a lot to the fish. And if people just leave it alone for a couple of years, it'll be habitat for a couple of years. And so while this bill doesn't go very far, having been involved in this for a long time, I know all change is incremental. And this is an incremental improvement on what we have now, and I would hope that you would pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, committee members. My name is Tom Wolf, the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. Just quickly, I want to mention that I, too, was part of the Healthy Stream Partnership and have been involved in this issue for a long time. We support this bill, but we also support the concerns that both the City of Portland and Native Fish Society has about Section 5, and we feel that to truly make this the strongest possible bill that can be made, their concerns should be dealt with. Before I move on more about that, I just want to talk about a tale of a river. One of the areas that we've been doing a lot of restoration, Trout Unlimited has been doing a lot of restoration in the last 12 years, is on the Metolius, which one of our members, tongue-in-cheek, once referred to it as the most beautiful river in Oregon not to catch fish in, because the Forest Service removed a lot of the wood from the stream over the years because the cabin owners on the river thought that it ruined the view of the stream. So it did make the stream look nicer, but it provided no habitat for the fish. Now the Forest Service is starting to put large woody debris back in the stream, and in a campground that we use for our projects that we do down there, you now can see kokanee landlocked sockeye spawn, and they're spawning in large numbers by this campground. And you can go out by where the large woody debris is and catch very large trout. So I'm not going to tell you what the name of that campground is, because I promised my members I wouldn't. But
I was going to say, I think I know.
Involved. You have to think this over.
Yeah.
I think I know where that is anyway.
So. Yeah, so anyway, so that large woody debris has been shown in many studies, and Bruce McIntosh talked about this, it's needed in streams. Besides water, it's the most important things. Studies have shown on coastal coho on the coast that during high water winter events, that without large woody debris to hide in and get shelter from those high flows, they'll be swept down and destroyed. So I think this bill, you know, whereas I do have reservations about Section 5, this is a great effort by Representative Witt and others that have carried this struggle on for a long time, and I would love to see this bill go forward and be enacted, because I think, whereas it's not perfect, but then again, which one of us is? So hopefully this bill can move forward, can be approved, and we can once again have large woody debris captured in our streams. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. I hope that was a rhetorical question.
Yes, it was rhetorical.
Anyway, Questions for any of these gentlemen?
I'm going to troll myself.
That's okay. I know he's dying to know where that...
I fish the Metoyas 4 or 5 times a year.
Yeah. And, have you caught much?
Yeah, I've seen them quite well the last few trips. It's really a great... If you've never been, you've got to go. It's the most beautiful river in Oregon.
I agree with you.
It's just a treasure. And you have to go, if you just want to go look at it, it's worth doing that.
But you're right, there's not a lot of large woody debris on that, at least the stretches that I have been on. So, all right, well, I appreciate your testimony. Doesn't seem like there's any questions. Anybody else would like to testify on this bill? Okay, so with that, we will go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2396A. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward, and we'll be definitely in contact. Thank you for your testimony. Okay, we are going to hear a last bill today, and colleagues, before I open up this hearing, I'm going to explain what this bill is and what this bill isn't. Senate Bill 360 was a placeholder bill for, as you will be hearing, a process that went on during the interim, and unfortunately found out after the amendment was written that the relating clause did not work. However, since the other bill is not ready yet, Senate Bill 837, we are going to go ahead and hear this bill because the background for 837 is the same. And since we had time to hear it today, so I'm hoping you'll take notes and remember that when it comes back up for Senate Bill 837. So you will hear the background today, and hopefully we can have a more expedited public hearing when Senate Bill 837 is back up.
837 in here?
Is it actually up yet in OLIS?
Madam Chair and committee members, yes, Senate Bill 837 was referred to committee, but it was after this was already scheduled for a public hearing.
So you could go ahead and pull up 837 and look at that, and I would suggest that because that is, in essence, what the replacement bill is. So with that, I will open up a hearing on Senate Bill 360, and Beth, do you want to explain what the bill, actually, I guess we'll have Brett come up and do that. So we have Brett Brownscombe from the governor's office. He's going to come up and provide background about what this bill does, what the work group process was, what the problem that this bill is trying to fix, the issue that it's trying to address. And then I think we're going to hear from some members of the work group, correct?
Correct. Okay. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, Brett Brownscombe, Natural Resource Policy Advisor to Governor Kitzhaber. With me, I wanted to bring up Bruce McIntosh from Department of Fish and Wildlife and Brenda Bateman from Oregon Water Resources Department, who have also been part of this work group that you've heard mentioned, and have some comments on the respective agency's perspective on the issue and the proposed solution. So, Senator Dingfelder, thank you for the background. That saves me a little time and as to the genesis of why we are where we are, where this is a hearing on Senate Bill 360, but the underlying vehicle that came out of the interim work group for delivery to you of a proposed solution is actually captured in Senate Bill 837. So the reason why we're here is in previous legislative sessions there have been efforts to advance in-conduit hydropower development in a variety of different ways and through a variety of different statutory mechanisms that would address tension between the objectives around hydropower development in conduit structures and the state's fish passage requirements. So to be brief, the reason we're here is because in past legislative sessions we've reached a stalemate and gridlock over the tensions between the two dual objectives that a variety of interests around the state have, one being in-conduit hydropower development and the other being fish recovery through fish passage. The current law is, we made without belaboring the detail, the current hydropower statutes that Oregon Water Resources Department oversees is when an applicant comes forward and applies for a certificate for a hydropower project that is an in-conduit hydropower project. There is a pathway that requires, there's an expedited pathway, but that pathway still requires those projects to be conditioned by the department upon a variety of conditions, including fish passage. The problem and the reason things became stuck was for a number of these in-conduit projects, the cost of doing fish passage at the diversion structure that is related to the conduit apparatus, whether it be a pipe or a canal, if you're in an agricultural setting, or a pipe in a municipal setting, the fish passage costs oftentimes could be enormous. And so you had this situation where you had an upfront cost barrier to the ability of in-conduit hydropower development projects to be done, and those projects therefore weren't moving forward. You had some, such as on in Central Oregon and Central Oregon Irrigation District, where there were agreements reached between the department and a project proponent over passage, but you also had a significant number of projects that just frankly weren't moving forward, not for reasons of a lack of technology, but for reasons of a regulatory structure that imposed a big upfront barrier to movement. And that captured the City of Astoria's project, which is the genesis behind Senator Johnson's Senate Bill 360. So the governor on this, we convened with the legislature a legislative interim work group, and I'll go through the members of that in a moment, but the governor has dual objectives, and the governor's interest in this bill is based on these dual objectives. One is renewable energy, represented through in-conduit hydropower development. The other is fish recovery, represented by advancement of fish passage. Those were the objectives that the work group set out to address, not exclusively, but mutually, and came to agreement upon a path forward, which is represented in Senate Bill 837. And the gist of it is we're not talking about building new dams or causing new barriers to fish passage. We're talking about existing canals, pipes, conduit infrastructure where there has already been screening done on the diversion associated with that canal, and where the placement of hydropower technology in that canal, pipe, or conduit will not have new ecological impacts on fish habitat because it's in an existing canal and screened. But we had to deal with this issue of what do we do about the fish passage condition requirement in the existing statute. So the status quo wasn't really working for both interests, the hydropower development and the fish passage interest, because the state does not have much in the way of an adequate funding source for doing fish passage barrier removal projects. We have some lottery dollars, but suffice to say, to make it short, the need is far greater than the supply of dollars to address the need. We also had a good chunk of interest in doing additional in-conduit hydropower development. So the work group solution on this, as represented in Senate Bill 837, and I'd like to just recognize the efforts of Senator Johnson on this, when we realized there was a relating to clause problem with Senate Bill 360 and the intended content of a legislative solution represented by the work group, the senator reacted quickly and advanced a remaining priority bill in short order, and with the help of legislative counsel, got that product developed, which has since been referred to this committee for a future hearing. So that was very much appreciated and remains appreciated. The gist of what Senate Bill 837 would do is create within the hydropower statute, so ORS 543765, an exception to the condition of fish passage for certain specific project types. So we're talking only about in-conduit projects here, not talking about dams, but conduit infrastructure that is not an integrated part of a dam. And only that exception would only be applicable if the project proponent was making annual payments into a new sub-account fund that is directed specifically to fish passage projects on the ground. This sub-account fund and the fee tied to payments by in-conduit proponents is not an upfront barrier fee. It's not a takes this dynamic of in conduit projects not being able to move forward because there was too much upfront cost on the fish passage end and reverses it. The exception would allow those projects to go forward so long as once they were up and running and demonstrating revenue production, a portion of that revenue through a fee that's based on a multiplier with graduating rate over a series of years, that money was put back into this fish passage restoration account once the project was up and running. Second component is this fish passage restoration sub-account. That account would be used specifically for on-the-ground project work. There's a cap on the amount of administrative cost agencies associated with doing on-the-ground work could take out of that to keep the money whole for meaningful fish passage work. The account can also receive other dollars other than the fees tied to this new proposed statutory scheme. So there's a leveraging component of this where the state can potentially get a whole lot more than we currently have for fish passage work. And the projects that would be advanced by this fund would be those mentioned as part of the state's fish passage priority list, as well as with consideration given to those projects where in conduit hydro proponents are paying the fee. And the fund would be overseen through the advice of the state's existing fish passage task force. There's also a five-year review in Senate Bill 837 where at the end of the 5 years, the agencies to my left and to my right would report back to the legislature on how this is working, both in terms of satisfying the objective, the dual objectives around in-conduit hydropower development, as well as improving the state's standing with respect to doing fish passage projects to promote fish recovery. So that's the gist of the concept. The work group who met on this included Department of Water Resources and Fish and Wildlife, as well as Northwest Hydropower Association, Oregon Water Congress, Trout Unlimited, Central Oregon Irrigation District, Water Watch, the City of Astoria, Native Fish Society, and the Energy Trust. A number of those folks are here today to provide more background on where we've been and why we're here, and why, from their interest perspective, we're here. And we have consensus within the work group around the general framework and concept that's presented in Senate Bill 837. This has been a result of a series of many, many meetings between the work group. We're at a point now where we have general consensus on the framework. There are likely to be a couple clarifying amendments on specific issues that would be ready for you when you hear Senate Bill 837. Happy to report we have some certainly more consensus than there has been on this issue the last time it was likely before this committee. So with that, I'll stop. And okay. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Before I take questions, can you make sure that everyone understands what an in-conduit hydropower project is and give an example, whoever wants to do that?
I would be happy to. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'd be happy to. I know there's a very clear example with visual evidence that's or visual depiction of the example that's going to be before you in a moment. So okay. If I might just hold that and okay. Allow the testimony to cover that.
Okay, great.
Thanks.
Did Department of Fish and Wildlife or the Water Resources Department want to add anything?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department. I think to get to your question just very briefly, placing a turbine in an already existing water pipe and capturing the energy that's already coursing through there and generating revenues from that energy is a common sense approach. That program, it's called an in-conduit hydro program, resides with the Water Resources Department. And when we return to talk about Senate Bill 837, we'll have a bit more detail on how that program operates and some caveats and components I think it's important for this committee to know about. But the reason that we're here this afternoon is more on a policy focus. The nexus between water and energy is a strong one here in the Pacific Northwest and a valuable one, both economically and environmentally. Oregon's first integrated water resources strategy, which was adopted this past summer, August 2012, recognizes the growing importance of this water and energy nexus. And the strategy actually goes a step further and has included in it recommended action number 4B that advocates that Oregon take advantage of existing infrastructure to develop hydropower. The recommended action highlights and urges greater use of the state's expedited process, which we were talking about just a little bit here already this afternoon, and actually highlights that for further work and further use in the future. So that's pulled out in the strategy. This specific technology and technique is highlighted there. We wanted to make sure that the committee knew about that this afternoon. The department's been participating in this work group, and we look forward to continued discussions on this topic.
Thank you. Did you want to say anything about the Fish Passage Program at Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife?
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, member of the committee, Bruce McIntosh, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm not going to add much to what Brett described. We provided some testimony here. I can tell you the department, along with water resources and project proponents, have been frankly stymied by the legal framework we've had to work in to meet the dual objectives of renewable energy and fish passage. And so the work we've done in the work group really moves us collectively forward on making progress on both fronts. So we look forward to working with you on that. The department does have a very active fish passage program, very strong laws in the state with the goal of getting fish passage on all streams in the state. But it's a goal that's achieved through time through triggers in the fish passage laws. So certain actions trigger requirements, and this was one of those. So it was a road when the original bill went through, paved with good intentions, but the reality of implementing it has proved to be a challenge for all parties involved.
Okay. Thank you. I first want to thank Brett, because I know that you've spent many hours of your life along with some of the people in the back of the room. But I appreciate the fact that you have a consensus product here, and I know it's taken about a year and a half to get there and many, many, many meetings. So hopefully committee members, you do have the actual bill in front of you that we could not get on the calendar in time because of the hearing notice time, so we will be hearing this actual bill next week. But I thought this background information is important for you to have, and then I know you will all read the bill line by line before the hearing next week, so if you have additional questions. Senator Hansel.
Could I just ask a quick summary, the difference between 360 and 837?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel.
300 and...
Senate Bill 360 was drafted specifically to address the city of Astoria's situation and with respect to fish passage and their in-conduit project. Okay. The amendments that you have to that bill were intended to capture the work group's efforts on this more global issue beyond the city of Astoria, but including solving that situation. Senate Bill 837, on the other hand, captures the full work of the work group on this issue. The amendments on Senate Bill 360, because of the relating clause issue, only capture a portion of the work group's work and not all of it. And certain key components of that work are left out of those amendments due to the relating clause problem, and gotcha. They are included, though, in the full package of Senate Bill 837.
And thank you for that question. It's a really good question. And, Brett, I just want to clarify, because we don't have the city of Astoria signed up at this point, and they may be testifying in 837. Does 837 then address the city of Astoria's issue, because it's a much broader bill?
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, yes, it does.
Okay. Other questions, Jim?
I don't quite understand how the money flows here. I'm reading it really quickly, and I haven't got the entire ORS. So there's language in here about $100 plus four times and then 10 times, whatever the hydropower fee amount is. I mean, are you developing a revolving fund here? Do you have some seed money? What's kind of going on here? How's the money flow?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates. So the way the money works is it's not a revolving fund so much as the creation of a new subaccount that doesn't currently exist. The funding would be supplied by specifically the in-conduit projects that are advanced as a result of the exception here and the payment of an in-lieu fee. So that fee is graduated and increases over time based on the expectation that
early on, an in-conduit hydropower project is going to be just getting going, just getting its legs under it. Over time, it will be generating more profit. And so the reason for the graduated fee is to protect the economic viability of the project, but also over time scale it up so that the money coming into the passage restoration fund is meaningful. And so this would be new money aimed at specific projects that the through the Fish Passage Task Force would be identified for use of these funds along with matching other funds. It's not a revolving fund, but it would be perpetual in the sense that annually fees from in-conduit projects would come into the fund, and to the extent there are growing numbers of in-conduit projects, there would be a growing amount of funds that would be multiplying year after year.
And you follow?
I understand that now. So first off, do you have an estimate of what kind of funds would be produced for that over the next 5 to 10 years? You always have some estimate of what we're doing here. And secondly, the money is going to be used by Fish and Game, I assume.
Fish and Wildlife, Fish and Games in California.
All right. Well, they go both ways, you know.
I
supported the other state. You know? They pulled me over last time, too. I'll talk about that later.
Were they doing an inspection on your boat?
Well, we
can talk later.
License, and this state's on the trailer, or this state's on the boat, and that state's on the trailer. They checked the computer on me before they let me go. And so the money would be going in a permanent account, sub-account, for Fish Passage, basically. That's what we're talking about here.
Okay. Correct. And before I take your question, I just want to mention that the reason this bill is here, we had a bill, I think it was not the last regular session. It was the last full session, because If these projects were required to install the Fish Passage up front, it would be cost prohibitive. So this is sort of a glide path for these projects to move forward and make sure that we're addressing the needs of Fish Passage at the same time if they would trigger increased costs for the project because of the Fish Passage. So, you know, this is, I believe, a good compromise because we're allowing these innovative projects to move forward, yet we're not completely exempting the need for addressing the Fish Passage issue. Senator?
Oh, my question was on that, too. I was just curious. I mean, there's this probably a fixed fee if they had to put the Fish Passage paraphernalia in at the start, which would be very high. But it would seem to me at some point in the production of electricity, they would have paid for what they would have otherwise had to pay up front. My question is any time down the road in this bill, do they come to the end of having to pay back into the fund?
When they met their costs.
Where they met the costs.
Good question.
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Hansel, thank you for that question. So the way this fee is structured is there's a $100 minimum fee, and so for small projects that don't generate that much, they would be paying just a minimum. This is an election, not a requirement, and so the bill would not require an in-conduit hydropower project that's proposed for a certificate to go this route. They could still go the traditional route of coming to an agreement, working with Department of Fish and Wildlife, and do an actual passage project at that proposed project site.
So
in that case, they would not have to pay the fee at all if they went that route. If they go the annual fee route, the recognition is a modest amount, roughly 2% of annual revenues from that project would go into the fund and be used for projects around the state that are passage priorities.
So I think what Senator Hansel, if I may, is getting at is this in perpetuity? In other words, is there, because what I see right now, and I know we're going to have a hearing on this next week, but it'd probably be helpful in case we do need an amendment to clear this up. The way that I'm reading it, I see here you have ABC under 14, big ABC, after the 10th year, but it doesn't talk about if, at some point, and say this project's going to go on, you know, the life of a turbine. We don't know how long that'll be. So I guess I think that's what you're getting at.
I mean,
is the fee in perpetuity, or is at some point you say when it equals the cost? And that's something maybe we can hear from the folks who are in the work group. Was that discussed at all?
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder and Senator Hansel, other work group members may speak to this directly, but the intent here is that it would be in perpetuity. Well, the fee would run along with the duration of the certificate. And so in the statute, the certificate tied to these projects are a 50-year duration certificate. So long as that certificate's in place,
just for the
and
renewable
so long
energy
as the proponent has
the RECs
chosen the path of the fee structure versus paying up front for the passage, they would be paying that fee, which is a portion of their annual revenues on an annual basis during the life of their certificate.
My question is, well,
I was just going to say we'll have some of the folks who are in the work group that can come up and speak to this as well.
Madam Chair.
But I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, I'm not, you know, I don't, you know, if you could regroup you may not have the money up front, but you would have paid off for it for 5 years, and 50 years down the road, you've got a whole different elected body that's running the city council or whatever that made the original decision. And if we're locked into something that, we've already paid for it multiple times, why do we have to, I can see the local government saying, why did they commit us to this? It was not a good deal for us. So I'm just trying to figure out if there was some way that when you reach the end, or if we paid it off, we ought to be able to group the benefit ourselves for it.
Yeah, if I may, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hansel, what I heard and what we may hear more from some of the work group members is folks said, look, we don't have those who want to do in conduit hydropower projects have said, we don't have a problem with fish and fish recovery and passage as a general matter. We get those values. It's just if we have to pay for that up front, it can oftentimes be in the millions of dollars, and it'll be a clear barrier to us getting any project done. And so this proposed solution would get at a portion of revenues over time that would be paid into a fund where they wouldn't have that upfront barrier, and the fee was intentionally set, and the way we worked this out in the work group was to be set at a level that would not impede the existence or the creation of new in-conduit hydropower projects, but it would also not eat so heavily into revenues that the project was non-viable in terms of the objectives of producing revenue for a municipality or irrigation district or serving as a providing that entity with the ability to reduce their costs for, say, pumping, for example.
Okay. Senator Olson?
Yes, Madam Chair, perhaps you can answer this. I don't know if the folks out there can. Mm-hmm. Can this fund be swept?
Actually, I'm going to ask ODF&W. I mean, basically any fund that is not constitutionally limited technically can be swept. I will ask the Ways and Means members here on the either end of the... But
they're having gone through this process a few times on sweeping funds. If they're not constitutionally protected, they probably can be swept. Okay. It's something we've learned through hard experience is a bad idea, and you should never do a really bad idea. Okay. And I hope that we have enough memory in this building that we don't do that in the future.
Thank you.
You're here. I second that one. Oh, that wasn't a motion. Okay. All right. Okay. Any other questions? Because we are running out of time. I want to make sure at least, and we are trying to keep this on a high level because we will be back here next week talking about this again. But now I know everyone will go home and read it line for line and then have the real detailed questions. Thank you for your work on this, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week again.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to have Jan Lee and April Snell, and actually Tom Wolf, and you're the last people signed up on this. Welcome, and I just want to, for the record, welcome Jan Lee, who was former Representative Lee, and we served together for a brief time. She was, I followed in her footsteps to some extent as being a water wonk, so it's great to see you here.
Thank you. And I also would like to say hello to my former colleague, Senator Bates, and Mark as well, if he were here. My name is Jan Lee. I'm the executive director of the Northwest Hydro Association and also a constituent of Senator Olson in Clackamas County. Our association represents six states, Alaska, the four Northwest states, and California in looking at hydro. Our members are the utilities, developers, irrigation districts, the whole realm of the industry. Conduit exemptions are kind of a new thing. They just started happening about 5 or 6 years ago when people saw that they could use their existing infrastructure to generate a worthwhile amount of electricity. And to further clarify what a conduit exemption is, I think if you take a look at the pictures that are enclosed with the testimony, there's a number of different kinds. First of all, there's this newest, well, next to the newest invention is a pipe that actually has turbines inside of it. It's buried in a concrete vault, and the electricity runs into a generator that is also in the vault. This particular project has already been installed down in San Antonio and Riverside, California, and the city of Portland is working with Lucid Energy right now to do one of those projects. The other kind is what you may have seen more of in the last couple years as we've looked at some legislation, and that's taking the canal in the irrigation district, piping it, and then having hydro at the end of it. So the last photo that you have is actually a schematic of the City of Astoria's project, which shows the diversion clear up in the left-hand corner, and the actual end of the pipeline where the generation is about 10 miles away. So these are really not associated with the diversion. And the very newest technology is this little guy from HydroVolts that you just drop in the canal. It's anchored in the canal, and it virtually has no pipeline or other infrastructure. And the picture that you have is from the Rosa Irrigation District up in Washington. So we, in working with the work group, I think we've come up with objectives that all of us can live with. There needs to be a few clarification amendments, but basically I think there's agreement on most of the proposals in the bill. One other thing I wanted to point out is that at the bottom of page 4 of 837, 15, then large A, B, and C that go over to the next page, talk about some of the exits from the fee. You can at any time stop and make an agreement with ODFW to do passage, and when you do that, ODFW has a requirement to help fund that to some percentage. The other thing that we like about this fund is it will also allow us, some of us in the working group want to go out and get some grants and other money, put that into the fund, make it grow faster. And there's a priority in the bill for the projects who are paying the fee to be funded as a priority, so that that's another way that they can exit the process. But I think it's just really important that we get these opportunities accomplished for green energy and be able to go forward with the projects, because several of these have just been sitting on the sidelines for a number of years. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your input. April?
For the record, April Snell, Executive Director with the Oregon Water Resources Congress. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some background information on the issue of in-conduit hydropower and fish passage. I've provided a very general handout, some of which that information is based on the years that our association has been working on this issue and isn't specific to the efforts of the work group or to Senate Bill 837. And in agreement with what Ms. Lee said, I do feel that while there are a few tweaks that need to be made to Senate Bill 837, it does represent the very hard work of the work group, and I look forward to coming back and speaking to you on that particular bill. But in brief, Oregon Water Resources Congress represents irrigation districts, water control districts, and other local government entities that deliver water for agriculture. In-conduit hydropower is a relatively new technology, as Jan has alluded to, that there's a lot of new technology out there that allows hydropower to be generated with less water and less elevation than what was needed in the past. And a lot of folks, when they think of hydropower, they think of Bonneville Dam. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about devices that are installed within canals or pipelines that are not on the river, have a screen to ensure that no fish get into them, and are very, they have no negative environmental impacts. And in fact, in addition to generating renewable energy, they often are a part of larger piping or lining or other conservation efforts that result in more water being placed in stream, some of which is permanently protected. So there's a lot of benefits all around. In 2007, the expedited permit process was created, which I understand Water Resources Department will speak to more specifically later on down the road. But at that point, our association felt that that would provide a pathway for these projects to move forward without having to go through the same environmental requirements that a large Bonneville-type project would have to go through. However, it became clear that there wasn't clarity in how ODF&W could apply their fish passage requirements. And I think Bruce McIntosh fairly succinctly said that they're willing to look at some things differently, but they have the constraints of the law to work within. And that means that they have to look at fish passage for all of these projects as well. The problem is that the upfront costs of installing fish passage are so large that they break these projects, which are usually at barely positive income, and it takes several years for that revenue to be generated through the hydropower. And so as a result of the fish passage requirements, the in-conduit hydropower projects are not moving forward at all, which results in no new benefits for the irrigation districts, no new renewable energy for the state of Oregon, and no benefit to the fish and wildlife in stream. So we've been working for several years, and this work group has been working very hard, and I think the language in the bill is a pathway forward to allow these in-conduit projects to move forward and pay into a fund that will provide meaningful fish passage without requiring those individual projects to pay for huge fish passage that is often extremely expensive and very hard to determine. The other factor that I think is important is that the fish passage requirements are placed after the application has been sent into Water Resources Department, and that means all of the engineering cost-benefit analysis has already been done. And so this is a very unpleasant surprise for the districts when they have to do that. The work group proposal would include a lot of things that I think would help with that. In addition to having this option for projects to pay into a fund, they would also have an opportunity to have a pre-application meeting with the Water Resources Department and Fish and Wildlife and have a clear understanding of what sorts of requirements are going to be asked of these projects. So with that, I think I'll sum up there, but I think that this is the work group issue and the resulting legislation in Senate Bill 837 with a few minor tweaks will allow for these clean, green, renewable energy projects to move forward in an environmentally and economically feasible manner while providing a meaningful fund to put in fish passage around the state. Thank you very much.
Tom?
Chair Dingfelder, committee members. For the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. Trout Unlimited has been a member of this work group. Kate Miller, our Northwest Water and Energy Coordinator, has been on that work group since it started and has been working very closely with the Governor's Office and other members of the work group. Kate is not able to come here today because, A, she lives in Seattle, and, B, she's skiing in Colorado. Because I practically live here in the building, she figured I should come and testify. And I said, because I have nothing else to do at 4:36 in the afternoon, I thought for sure I'll come and say something. Hydro, and there's what's called in our world the four H's, which is hydro, habitat, harvest, and hatchery, which is four things that can cause detrimental effects to salmonid populations. And obviously hydro dams is one of that. One of the things that's come along in the last few years that's kind of a new thing for us when it comes to hydro is in-conduit hydro, and we're still kind of working our way around how do we address this, how do we make it better, how do we deal with the issues, how do we pay for it. And the work group has been doing some great work on looking at innovative ways to come up with funding for this, because fish passage, fish screening is not a cheap issue, as several people have mentioned. It takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of planning, but it's very essential for the preserving and protecting the our native wild salmon and trout. So Trout Unlimited supports the concepts of Senate Bill 837. We support what the work group is trying to do. We still need to see the final language, but we think that the steps that the governor's office and the work group is taking and moving forward is the right steps, and we look forward to the final project results. Thank you.
Great, thank you. I do have quick questions. I'm going to try to keep this on the high level because we'll be back here next week with 837. Can you talk a little bit about what's the average amount of electricity that's generated from these in-conduit hydro projects? Maybe, Jan, you can address that. And then also, if there's excess, I'm assuming that during certain times of the year, you're using the electricity or would use the electricity to offset your pumping needs, but are you selling it back at the other times of the year? And then how are you connecting to the grid?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. These projects really range in many sizes, all the way from a little 10-kilowatt backyard project to 3 to 5 megawatts in some of the larger irrigation districts. And generally, the power is sold and not used within the system. I can't think of any project where the system is using the power itself.
And are there, as far as connecting to the grid, are there any issues?
That interconnection is done through the utilities, so the developer puts together an interconnection agreement with whatever utility territory they're in, and that connection then takes place and the power goes to that utility, Madam Chair.
Okay, and my last question is, do we have any in-conduit hydro projects already operating in Oregon? I'm certainly familiar with others in other states.
Yes, Madam Chair, we do. The irrigation district started out with those projects. So in Central Oregon, the Swale Irrigation District and Central Oregon Irrigation District, which is shown in this photograph the bottom of April's testimony, both have projects. The Three Sisters Irrigation District will have a project this fall. The City of Portland will have the first Lucid Energy Pipeline project completed in August, to my understanding.
Okay. And they have all gone through then the full application process, I'm assuming, because we don't have this in place yet.
Madam Chair, the irrigation districts in Central Oregon developed an agreement with Fish and Wildlife for a payment plan to go forward with fish passage. The City of Portland already had a waiver from the Fish and Wildlife Commission.
All right. I'll see if there's any other questions. Senator Olson?
Ms. Lee, thank you very much for your testimony and for these wonderful graphics. Question on your conduit, your 10-mile from diversion project picture here. How many times can you put in a generator in that 10-mile length? Is it just one, or can you put more than one in there? Not as you go like 4 miles and stick another one.
Senator Olson, Chair Dingfelder, you can actually, depending on the elevations, have multiple drops, but you have to have a drop in elevation at each site, so you'd have to keep going down with each site.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much for coming here, and I'm assuming we'll probably see you again in another week or so. Do we post those agendas yet? Okay, we will be posting them very soon, so make sure and check on the computer, on your computer, and hopefully we'll be able to get the full range of testimony, but we appreciate you providing the background. I think that's really helpful. So with that, we will go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 360. Beth, anything else for today?
No, Madam Chair, I think that's
everything. Okay, great. So with that, we are adjourned.